Hello and welcome to Pythagorean Astronomy. I'm Chris North, and what you're about to listen to was originally broadcast as part of Pythagoras' Trousers, a science and engineering show on Radio Cardiff. You can find a full show and listen to past episodes at pythagorastrousers.co.uk. But for now, here's this month's astronomy. Earlier this month, there was more exciting news from the LIGO experiment, which is on the hunt for gravitational waves, ripples in space-time. The first ever detection of gravitational waves occurred in September 2015 and was announced in February this year. The objects that caused the gravitational waves were two black holes, spiralling in and colliding in the most energetic process we've ever witnessed by humankind. The latest news was of another two detections, albeit one of them rather weak, of gravitational waves, both of them also from pairs of black holes spiralling in and merging. One of the next big steps in this voyage of scientific discovery is to understand those black holes and to see if they can tell us anything about the universe at large. That research has as much to do with understanding their origins as it does to do with their fates. And to find out more about these black holes and their origins, I'm joined now by Professor Stephen Smart of Queen's University Belfast. Welcome to the programme, Stephen.
Thank you.
So, firstly, black hole's a term that many people will have heard, but there are quite a lot of misconceptions about them in the media and Hollywood and so on. So let's start with what I hope is a fairly easy one. What is a black hole?
So a black hole is an object which is denser than normal matter. That's a fairly simple statement. We know the densest form of matter that we can see in the universe are neutron stars. So a neutron star is a stellar object which has got the density of an atomic nucleus. So this is about somewhere between 1.4 and 2 times the mass of the Sun, but squashed down into a size of about 10 to 20 kilometers, a star of 10 to 20 kilometers in diameter. So the density is pretty amazing. If you could squeeze all of humanity onto a teaspoon, that would be the density of neutron star material. And that's the density of an atomic nucleus. That's the densest form of normal matter that we know. We can see these neutron stars in our galaxy. There are plenty of them. They're pretty common. We think they're formed in supernova explosions. So a black hole is an object which is even denser than a neutron star. And so that means that it's not normal matter. And the mathematical description of it is a singularity. But if you imagine a neutron star of that density, which is then squashed down into smaller dimensions than this 10 to 20 kilometer radius, that is not stable matter. And that is a form of matter which we can't see because the black hole doesn't emit radiation. So it's a black hole is a form of matter which is denser than normal. So you just squeeze down material into a form which is denser than an atomic nucleus.
And you mentioned these are formed in, or the neutron stars and a lot of these black holes are formed in supernova explosions. So this is the deaths of massive stars. Can you talk us through what a supernova explosion is? You know, we start from a very massive star, and what happens to make it form a supernova?
So massive stars, so stars more than about 8 to 10 times the mass of the Sun, will go through a series of burning episodes in their core. So the Sun is burning hydrogen to helium in its core, and it's releasing energy. That happens in massive stars as well. They burn their hydrogen much quicker. When all of the hydrogen has been used up in the core in a massive star, it's still hot enough that the helium that is produced can burn to produce carbon and oxygen. And that after that happens, the core is still hot enough that the carbon and oxygen can burn to give heavier elements such as magnesium, silicon, sulfur. And eventually, the core if the star is massive enough, and again, it's probably above a minimum mass of about 10 times the mass of the Sun, you get an iron core, a core made of iron. And that cannot burn to heavier elements and release energy. So you end up with an unstable core that cannot produce enough energy to hold the star up. So a star's life is a constant battle between gravitation, the gravitational potential energy of the star, trying to collapse it, and this thermal pressure in the core released during these nuclear explosions that hold the stars up. And during a star's life, it's a perfect balance. But at the end of the star's life, when it has an iron core, it cannot hold itself up. And so that iron core collapses, and the release of that energy as it collapses causes the star to explode. And when this shockwave, when the core collapses, a shockwave is launched in the core of the star. When it hits the surface, the whole star completely explodes. And that's what we call the supernova explosion. And they can be as bright as a whole galaxy for a period of a few weeks.
And we see those in the sky. We see them every few days now, I guess. We have things that find a supernova. They, as you say, they're as bright as galaxies. They appear as this bright spot, normally in a distant galaxy or maybe a nearby galaxy, a bright spot that appears as a new star in the sky. That's where supernova, the name comes from, new star, very, very bright.
Yep.
Now, that tells us, so seeing a bright spot in the sky tells us there's been a big explosion of a massive star. How do we know whether it's formed a neutron star or black hole, or can we predict what's happened to it?
So the clearest evidence where we think we've seen a star collapse and form a neutron star and produce a supernova was back in 1987. So the first supernova of that year, 1987A it was called, was discovered in the Large Magellanic Cloud, which is one of the closest galaxies to the Milky Way. It's not visible from the northern hemisphere, only from the southern hemisphere. And in that galaxy, it's very close, it produced a bright supernova, which was seen, detected from Australia, Chile, and New Zealand very quickly. And at that time, there were two experiments running which detected neutrinos. So these are fundamental particles that weakly interact with matter, one in Japan and one in the US. And they detected a very short burst of neutrinos at pretty much the same time as the supernova was discovered. So these neutrinos are produced when the core of the star collapses, forms a neutron star, and you get a burst of these neutrinos which are released. And these neutrinos help to drive the supernova explosion. So we saw a supernova, a bright flash in this nearby galaxy. We saw a coincident neutrino burst, and we went and we also detected the star before it had exploded, because that galaxy had been mapped many times by images of the southern sky by telescopes in Australia and Chile. So we saw a massive star, we saw the neutrino burst, we saw the supernova, and now the star, of course, has disappeared. So that's pretty good evidence that our idea of the core collapsing, forming a neutron star, and releasing neutrinos is correct. And of course, we see these neutron stars all around the galaxy. We see them. We see the neutron stars in the centers of what we call supernova remnants. So supernova that exploded in our own galaxy, say 300-400 years ago, up to 1,000 years ago, in many of these remnants. So you see the gas expanding. It looks like you're looking at the inside of a star, which is completely exploded, which is exactly what has happened. And at the centers of some of those remnants, we call them supernova remnants. In the centers of those, we often see bright points or X-ray sources, and those are the little neutron stars which are left over after the explosion. So there's plenty of evidence that these neutron stars are formed in supernova explosions. Now, your question of when do neutron stars form and when do black holes form in supernova explosions is an area which of that people are working on at the minute. So we think the more massive a star is before it collapses, as the shockwave leaves the center of the star, so if you imagine in each case, a neutron star is immediately formed when the core collapses, and then a shockwave tries to get out of the star. If the star is too massive, it's likely that shockwave doesn't or may not have enough energy to actually reach the surface and cause the star to explode. It may be that it just stops, stalls, and the whole star starts to implode on the newly formed neutron star, and then in effect you may not get an explosion at all, and a black hole might be formed just by the star collapsing because it doesn't have enough, the shockwave doesn't have enough energy to get out of the star. Now, what produces a black hole and what produces a neutron star? It's probably to do with mass, almost certainly to do with the initial mass of the star. The more massive a star is, the more likely it is to form a black hole. And the less massive a star is, the more likely it is to form a neutron star.
So we have ideas for when these black holes form and when neutron stars are formed. Now, presumably, if a black hole is formed, the shockwave hasn't got out of the star, there's not a flash of light. There'll be neutrinos, I assume, because those pass through everything pretty much, but there won't be a flash of light. So those supernovae where a black hole has formed, we haven't seen them. Is that right?
So that's one prediction, yes, from this idea and this concept and the idea that black holes may be formed by these massive stars that collapse and implode. And there is some evidence for that, we think. So for many years and for about 15, 16 years now, myself and my own group here, we've been looking for to directly detect the progenitors of supernovae in nearby galaxies. Many of these nearby galaxies have been imaged by telescopes like the Hubble Space Telescope and large telescopes on the ground. And all of these archive images exist in computer databases all around the world. So we can go and search in those, and we can say if a supernova is found in the nearby galaxy, we can go and search all of the computer databases all around the world and say, has anybody ever taken an image of that galaxy before the supernova was discovered? And if they have, we can go and say, well, can we identify the star which exploded? So a very similar thing that was done back in 1987. It was quite easy to do that in the case of 1987A because the galaxy was so close. But the Hubble Space Telescope has taken such fantastic images of nearby galaxies that we can do this on quite a regular basis now. So what we find there is that for normal bright supernovae, we do see stars at exactly the position of the supernova in these nearby galaxies. And in many cases, those have been shown to disappear after the supernova exploded. So we see a bright flash, we see the star, the massive star beforehand, and we often see it disappear. And in those cases, the mass of the star that we estimate seems to be between about 8 times the mass of the sun, and some are between 15 to 20, let's say 17 is about the highest mass we've seen. And we haven't seen anything higher than 17 times the mass of the sun. So that was a bit of a surprise then. So it may be that we're seeing the bright supernovae from these lower massive stars, if you like, the stars in the range of 8 to 17 times the mass of the sun, but we don't see the supernovae coming from the stars above 17 solar masses. So that's suggesting to us that those stars have to die in some way, and their core has to collapse. There's no other way. There's no other endpoint for them, really. It's suggesting to us that there is a population of stars dying out there that we may not have detected their explosive deaths or their implosive deaths.
And you say these massive stars out there, the black holes that were discovered by LIGO, the gravitational waves, the merging black holes that were observed by LIGO in the form of gravitational waves, the first ones that were detected, certainly back in September 2015, were really quite massive. They were about 30 times the mass of the sun each. So what kind of mass star do you need to result in a black hole, which is only the bit that's left, essentially, that's 30 times the mass of the sun? The initial star, the progenitor, as it's called, must have been pretty massive.
Oh, that's right. So it needs to be more than about 80 times the mass of the sun, an initial mass of about 80 times the mass of the sun, at least. So LIGO has really opened up a new window on how black holes form. It's a stunning discovery, not just from the point of view of the detection of gravitational waves, but the astrophysical implications of having two massive black holes, as you say, around 30 times the mass of the sun, is pretty amazing, and no one expected the first one to be like this, and so probing the masses of black holes has been a difficult process for many years, of course, because they're black and so they're hard to find. So the way we typically find them in our galaxy is we find where a black hole has a binary companion, a star going around it, and the black hole pulls off and accretes matter from that binary companion, and that material, as it swirls towards the black hole, gets very hot, and it often gives off X-rays and emits at other types of other radiation. And so that's the way we find them. We find them not from seeing the black hole itself, but the material swirling around them. And so they're typically the largest masses have been around 10 to 15 solar masses, the largest black holes known. So these already, the LIGO black hole masses, are already the most massive black holes known from the stellar point of view. So what can produce them? Probably massive stars above 80 times the mass of the sun. So massive stars, as they're born with 50 to 100 solar masses, what happens during their lifetime is they lose mass. Because the radiation pressure is so high at their surface, they tend to drive off a lot of their outer atmosphere, and they lose mass in what are called stellar winds. So this has been known for several decades, that massive stars lose mass, and they will end up with much lower masses than they start out with. So we think you need a star of initial mass above 80 solar masses. It loses, let's say, 50 solar masses during its lifetime through these normal, fairly normal stellar winds. And it ends up with a core of about 30 solar masses. The final endpoint then would be that its core produces iron, it collapses, it can't produce the shockwave can't get out of the star, and the whole thing collapses into a 30 solar mass black hole. But that needs to happen twice in a binary system to give you the LIGO, the configuration of the LIGO source.
But the binary star idea with two black holes or two very massive stars together, is that what you'd expect from massive stars to get them? Would you expect them more or less frequently to appear in these binary systems?
So binary stars are actually very common. So over the last 5 to 10 years, there's been a huge effort to work out what's the fraction of massive stars that exist as single stars, and what are the fraction that exist in multiple systems, either binaries or triples or higher order systems. So it turns out that at least 50%, probably closer to 70% of massive stars are in binary systems. Now, if they're wide enough binaries, if their initial separation is very large, the two stars might just exist happily on their own. They'll evolve on their own without interacting at all. And so effectively, you've got two single stars which just happen to be orbiting around each other, but everything else would progress as if they were two single stars. However, it seems that of these 70% of massive stars, 50 to 70% that are in binary systems, at least half of those are in systems which are close enough that they will interact during their lifetime. So that means that as they evolve, their atmospheres swell up a little bit, and so they are close enough to each other that the gravitational field of their companion star affects the other one, and that can pull material off the companion. So the more the star that starts out which more massive, it will evolve a little bit quicker, and it may end up dumping material, some of its atmosphere, onto the companion star, and that will significantly affect the evolution of them. So we know that they exist in binary systems, so it's not unexpected that the LIGO event happened, and that it was the progenitor system has to be two massive stars. There are quite a few known binary systems of very massive stars between 50 and 100 solar masses, which are known in our own galaxy and in the Magellanic Clouds. So that's not unexpected. So these massive binary systems do exist. They're rarer than normal stars because we know that the more massive a star is, the rarer, the less frequent they are. It's called the famous term for it in astronomy is called the initial mass function. So if you look at a cluster of stars which form out of a collapsing cloud, you get many more low mass stars forming than high mass stars. So high mass stars are rarer than sun-like stars, for example, but it is certainly not unusual to find massive stars in binary systems such as produce the LIGO burst.
And you say that they're not that unusual. That the second firm detection that occurred on Boxing Day 2015, so last December, that was of two black holes that were much more in line with what we've seen before. They were between 5 and 20 times the mass of the sun, so a sort of more modest mass black hole. But these are seen out to distances of about 1 billion light years, and for the weaker detection, possibly 2 billion light years, 1.5 to 2 billion light years. So these are seen really far away, and if you can see them that far out, and as LIGO improves its sensitivity over the next few years and gets, say, three times more sensitive, it can then see these things even further out. There could be a lot of these, right?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think stellar astronomers are very excited about the LIGO detections because it can give them a window into the the masses of and the populations of black holes that exist in binary systems, of course, but as I say, these are that's not unusual to find them in binary systems. We know that most stars are. So it's a great opportunity to use a new method to try and probe the black hole population of the universe. Because as I've said, finding, say, two black holes in a binary system in our own galaxy is almost impossible because they're black. They don't emit radiation. Unless you have another star there, which is made up of normal matter, and normal stars are made up mostly of hydrogen and helium. So unless you have matter orbiting the black hole, getting drawn into the black hole, becoming hotter and emitting radiation, you just can't see these things. There are other methods that have been tried to find these black holes and dark masses within our own galaxy, but potentially LIGO could open up another window in probing what the range of masses are of black holes. Is there an upper limit? For example, will we find 100 solar mass black holes or 200 solar mass black holes? I think it's probably not surprising the first one was so massive because they were looking for a really strong signal, first of all, of course, and those are probably going to come from the most massive systems. So it will be interesting to see what the distribution of events are as LIGO becomes more sensitive. Are they more like 5 to 10 solar, most of the systems, 5 to 10 solar masses, or do they tend to be towards the higher mass end? And of course, we expect to see neutron stars merging. And the interesting thing there is that for neutron stars that merge, we may be able to detect something at electromagnetic radiation in the few days after LIGO detects the gravitational waves, which is very exciting.
So we'll see a flash of light and be able to combine the two types of astronomy, our electromagnetic astronomy, classical astronomy, if you like, with our new gravitational astronomy, which is very exciting.
Yes.
Well, it's certainly going to be an exciting few years as LIGO improves its sensitivity and tells us more about these black holes. And I guess you're going to have your work cut out for you understanding what this all means for stellar evolution. So Professor Stephen Smart, thanks very much.
Thank you, Chris.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North. It was originally broadcast on Radio Cardiff as part of Pythagoras' Trousers.